It's Monday, June 8th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. In the next half hour, leaders of the Group of Seven World Powers hold a second day of meetings in Germany. We'll get an update from our correspondent near the scene on what they've been discussing. Turkey's pro-Kurdish opposition party makes a strong showing in parliamentary elections. Our correspondent in Turkey tells us what that means for the future of the country's Islamist-rooted government. And
In my judgment, this was an attack by China against the United States government. It quantifies to espionage.
A U.S. congressman lays the blame for the recent hacking of U.S. government computers. It's all ahead in International Edition. Leaders of the Group of Seven industrialized nations have been meeting for a second and final day in the German southern state of Bavaria. I spoke earlier to our correspondent Al Pessin, who is near the summit venue, and asked him what's been on the agenda of the summit today.
Well, as always, the G7 has a very broad agenda. Traditionally, they always talked about the global economy and trade, and that's certainly on their agenda this time, with Europe continuing to come only slowly out of the recession, and with trade talks ongoing for transatlantic and trans-Pacific trade agreements. So there's a lot to talk about on that front. And then there are also other long-term type of issues that they have dealt with for years, even decades, like climate change. That's a major focus today. And Chancellor Merkel, who is the hostess of the summit, and President Obama and some of the others, want to reach agreement among themselves on important climate change targets in advance of a key meeting in Paris in December, a global meeting on climate change. So they want to have a common position going in there in order to get further reductions in carbon emissions from China and from developing countries. So those are the long-term issues that they're talking about yesterday and today. But they're also dealing with world hotspots. They're meeting with the Prime Minister of Iraq. They're talking to some African leaders and dealing with all sorts of current issues in the world where the G7 plays an important military role and also an important humanitarian role.
What are the expectations about any decisions that may come out of the G7 summit on these issues such as climate change and on matters of global security, including the fight against ISIS?
Well, we'll see in a couple of hours whether they've reached agreement on climate change or whether they've left that to lower-ranking officials to continue to talk about any issues that aren't settled. On the major global security issues like the Islamic State, they're quite united, and several of the countries are involved in the military and humanitarian efforts in that regard. And on Russia, there is some expectation that they will agree to continue sanctions on Russia as long as it continues its policies in Ukraine, supporting the separatists in the east, and continuing what they see as its illegal occupation and annexation of the Crimea region. And they may also indicate their willingness to increase sanctions in the future if Russia and or the separatists increase their military activity in eastern Ukraine. So they can be expected to take a very united stand on that issue as well.
And that was VOA correspondent Al Pessin in the German town of Garmisch-Partenkirchen. While President Obama discusses trade and other matters with his G7 counterparts in Germany, the fate of two major international trade agreements could be determined by an upcoming vote in the U.S. House of Representatives. VOA's Michael Bowman has more.
Amid smiles and frivolity in Germany,
there's never a bad day for a beer, and vice versa.
Behind the scenes drama persists. The United States is the linchpin of proposed trade pacts spanning the Atlantic and the Pacific, but Washington is far from unified on authorizing simple yes or no congressional votes to approve them.
We've still got a lot of work to do, but it all begins with TPA and this vote.
Most Republicans, like Paul Ryan, support pending trade deals.
The stakes are really high, because in the global economy, if you are not moving forward, you are falling behind. China is negotiating trade deals all over the world, and they're trying to rig the rules in their favor. So it all comes down to this question: is China going to write the rules of the global economy, or are we?
But Republicans will need more than token Democratic backing, and so far fewer than 20 House Democrats are on record supporting TPA.
I can tell you that it is a very large number in our caucus that is not supportive of it.
House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi puts the burden on Speaker John Boehner.
It's absolutely Speaker's responsibility. It's where the support exists in his caucus. He has the majority.
But Boehner is doing some finger-pointing of his own, saying if President Obama wants trade deals, he needs to convince fellow Democrats to support them.
We're working to get the Trade Promotion Authority finished. Talked to the president yesterday. He's got some work to do, too.
The White House believes TPA will pass. Spokesman Josh Earnest.
Based on the success that we had in convincing nearly a third of the Democrats in the Senate to support this legislation, we're optimistic that we have the opportunity to make that case to progressives across the country and to Democrats in the House of Representatives. We can give them a reason to support this bill.
The proposed trade pacts have the firm backing of America's business community, but are strongly opposed by labor and environmental groups. Michael Bowman, VOA News, Washington.
This is VOA. This is VOA's International Edition with me, Michael Lippin. Turkish voters have dealt a blow to their president's plan to expand his powers after his ruling Justice and Development Party, or AKP, failed for the first time to win an outright majority in Sunday's parliamentary election. It's the biggest setback in 13 years for the AKP. Mr. Erdogan had been seeking a two-thirds majority in the 550-seat parliament to create a presidential-led republic. But with virtually all the votes tallied, unofficial results showed his Islamist-rooted Justice and Development Party winning 41% of the vote, well down from the nearly 50% that it won 4 years ago. For the first time, the pro-Kurdish People's Democratic Party, or HDP, cleared the 10% vote count threshold that it needed to join parliament, giving it 80 lawmakers in the assembly. I spoke earlier with VOA Kurdish reporter Mutlu Sivaroglu in the southeastern Turkish city of Gaziantep. I asked him about the likelihood that the AKP will form a coalition with a Nationalist Movement Party, or MHP, which also won 80 seats.
I think currently this seems like to be the strongest possibility, because HDP made it clearly before the elections and even after the elections, the HDP leader Demirtas clearly stating that they are not going to be in any formation of coalition government with the AK party. So MHP seems strong, but also there is calls, appeals that CHP, the main opposition, and the RKP, AKP, they should form a strong national coalition. This might be an possibility. Also, there is also a scenario that CHP, MHP, then HDP supports externally against AK party. So at the moment, scenarios are a lot. But there's also some people say that there should be early elections are inevitable. So right after the first day of the election, there are so many scenarios, but the current scenario, either AKP will form a minority government and they are going to be supported externally by MHP or form a coalition with MHP, or AK party or CHP will form a stronger government that the other two smaller parties, relatively smaller parties, will support them.
And the CHP, of course, is the main secular opposition party. Now, and you're in the city of Gaziantep, which is in the southeast of Turkey. What are people saying there on the streets about the election results?
Here, it's one of the biggest surprises in Turkey. AK party lost very significantly, below over 61% to 46-something. So it's, they lost a lot of votes. And surprisingly, HDP wins two seats. First time HDP wins a seat in this parliament and not one, two. So HDP party wins two first time, and the number of seats are two. And besides, MHP party also wins two, and CHP also two. So AKP lost a great base to HDP and to some base to MHP, whereas CHP remains strong. So people here are, they were already, Mike, while we were walking on the streets, there were reaction against AKP candidates because first five candidates are out of town. And the locals were upset that the AK party brought outsiders. So there was a reaction. But at the same time, HDP, the number one candidate was the former mayor of this city. He has been the mayor for 15 years, Celal Doğan, his name. So he had a very strong popularity. And the second candidate is a professor, and very known by the Kurdish supporters, Kurdish voting base. So this is a great achievement for HDP, scoring this amount of votes, over 15%, and securing two seats in the parliament. In Turkey's sixth biggest city, but of course, it's a big, big blow for government, Mr. Erdogan, Mr. Davutoğlu's AK party. Want to add, Mike, I'm in the electoral center of the HDP party. The celebrations are ongoing since last night. Even today, it's crowded. I'm right now, right there. People are very happy and very proud in HDP office.
And that was Mutlu Sivaroglu of VOA's Kurdish service in Gaziantep. Well, VOA's Andrew Palchevsky is joining me now in the studio to tell me about what some of the hot topics on the Turkey election have been on social media, Andrew.
Absolutely. It's been a huge trending topic on social media. First off, during the election, there were over 1,000 cases of fraud reported through social media. So people are using this tool as kind of an election monitoring tool, which is an interesting use of social media. And I want to talk briefly about a photo that's been trending. There was a bombing this past week. Two people were killed, 200 injured at an HDP rally. There's a photo that's going viral of a gentleman. He claims to be an HDP supporter, bandaged from head to toe, but he's out there casting his vote. People using this as kind of a rallying cry on social media, showing that they have such great and committed supporters, and the results seem to indicate that, in fact, they do.
Thank you very much, Andrew. Yes, I did see that some of those injured Turks had been voting. That's quite impressive. So thanks very much, Andrew Palchevsky. This is VOA.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at hashtag VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, at Perry Cal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
And you're listening to VOA's International Edition. The chairman of the U.S. House of Representatives Homeland Security Committee, Congressman Michael McCaul, says threat indicators point to China as being responsible for the hacking of U.S. government computers revealed last week. But as VOA's Victor Beatty reports, the White House says the identities and motives for the attack remain under investigation.
McCaul, appearing on U.S. television Sunday, says the hacking of computer systems at the Office of Personnel Management involving the records of up to 4 million current and former federal employees is the most significant breach of federal networks in U.S. history.
We look at the threat indicators. Who has a motive intent to steal this data? This is a huge data mining project, and it targeted political appointees in the federal government and federal employees, 4 million of them. In my judgment, this was an attack by China against the United States government. It quantifies to espionage.
McCaul says the source of the attack, discovered in April and made public last Thursday, has not yet been confirmed, but the way it was carried out suggests to him the Chinese government was involved.
The attribution, what they call it, to go back to the source, has not been confirmed by the United States government, but I believe, in my judgment, that all the threat indicators point to the fact it is China and perhaps nation state sponsored because of the way it was done. It was not done to steal credit card information and that kind of theft. It was done to get personal information on political appointees in the federal government and federal employees to exploit them so that later down the road they can use those for espionage to either recruit spies or compromise individuals in the federal government.
Referring to the breach earlier this year of tens of millions of personal files at the Anthem Health Insurance Company, McCaul says the attack on OPM came from the same source in China. China has called the accusation irresponsible and unscientific. An editorial published Monday in the state-controlled Global Times characterized the hacker issue as a stick with which the United States readily beats China, but one that the U.S. is never able to provide concrete evidence. A Chinese foreign ministry spokesman has said such attacks are generally anonymous and their origins are hard to trace. White House spokesman Josh Earnest during the Group of Seven summit in Germany says the investigation into the OPM hacking by the Federal Bureau of Investigation continues.
The identity of the individuals who are behind this attack and the motives of those who carried out this intrusion are still the subject of the ongoing investigation. And so I don't want to say anything at this point that would get ahead of that ongoing investigation.
China analyst Scott Kennedy of the Washington-based Centers for Strategic and International Studies says he is suspicious of Chinese involvement given their recent statements that do not include a clear denial. Kennedy describes the bilateral relationship as complex, but cautions that distrust is on the rise.
We can address day-to-day issues, trade, commercial issues, some types of security issues, even Iran, but on those sensitive issues, basically, both sides seem to be relatively dug in, and Xi Jinping and the leadership in China, I think, is testing the Obama administration, given that it's in its last year and a half. They're trying to perhaps push to see how much they can get without getting significant pushback from the United States.
The United States and China are scheduled to hold their latest round of strategic and economic dialogue in 2 weeks here in Washington. Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute. I'm Rick Pantaleo. NASA's mission control at the Johnson Space Center in Houston, Texas, recently celebrated its 50th anniversary. The Flight Control Center was first put into operation on June 3, 1965, for the Gemini 4 space mission. Glenn Lunny, a flight director during NASA's Gemini and Apollo programs, returned to mission control to celebrate and reminisce.
I mean, it's a special place to us. And, we lived here, and it just flows back when we come in. It just starts roaring back, and we remember all the good times.
NASA's Mission Control was renamed the Christopher C. Kraft Jr. Mission Control Center in 2011 to honor the legendary flight director who played an important role in establishing the mission control operation. And that's your Science in a Minute. I'm Rick Pantaleo.
And you're listening to International Edition with me, Michael Lippin. Music has a powerful influence on many of us, and as time goes by, we tend to remember songs in connection with life events and sometimes the special people in our lives, as VOA's David Byrd explores in our studio with Shauna Renee.
If you've ever been in a romantic relationship, you know that there might be what you refer to as our song, a tune that just kind of encapsulates the way you feel about that special person. Well, what if the artist that was performing your song actually got on a dating website and tried to get other people to make it their song? Well, that's what we're going to talk about with Shauna Renee. Shauna, I understand some major artists have done this. They've gone on dating websites and posted links to their latest tune.
Yeah, it's actually really fascinating. Recently, maybe around March or April, we started hearing rumblings that Hillary Duff was on Tinder. She said, I'm going to go on Tinder. She had just divorced her husband. She said, I'm going on Tinder. I'm going to find someone. And folks thought, wow, that's really cool that an artist would do it. Well, turns out that she started a Tinder profile, actually hooked up with a couple of guys, well, went on a date with a couple of guys.
Okay, let's clear that up. I want to make sure we clear that up.
Went out on a date with a few guys, and those dates were filmed and used as part of her experience, was used as part of a music video. So this was sort of the first time we had seen Tinder and music come together. Then, all of a sudden, we hear that Jason Derulo decides to promote his latest single on Tinder. But here's how it works. Tinder will create a profile, just a random profile of someone very beautiful or extremely handsome, with the hopes that you'll come across them and you'll swipe right. Now, right is yes, left is no.
For accepting or rejecting that person's
right.
profile.
Right. I think you're cute or not so much. So if you swipe right, then you automatically get a link. A link to his YouTube page pops up, and you get to actually see the video. So they, in essence, embed the video into the experience. And millions of people, to no surprise, swiped right and were able to see the video. And then from there, they got a link to his iTunes account or the ability to buy it on iTunes. So this worked out really well. Mariah Carey then decided, well, why don't I try to use a dating app as well? Now, she's a little older, and so she decided to go for another dating site. Match.com, she thought, would be more her style. So she created or had a profile created for her on Match.com.
Now, wait a minute. Mariah Carey on Match.com.
Mariah Carey has a profile on Match.com.
You can get it. I bet that went nuts.
It's her. And she tells you what kind of, she's self-employed. You can ask her later about how much money she makes. She's got two kids. They live at home.
Occupation diva.
All right. Divorce. You know, so you get all the pertinent information. But you also get to see her new music video embedded right there on her profile. So, of course, once again, she is using the dating site as a means to promote her music.
Well, Shauna, thank you very much. That is Shauna Renee. Now, where can people find you on VOA? What's your show?
So I am on VOA 1 every single day. And then you can also catch me every Monday as I host the Soul Lounge, which is all about soul, neo-soul, R&B, and hip-hop music.
All right, that is Shauna Renee. And you can find the Soul Lounge on our website. That's voanews.com.
You've been listening to International Edition. Your director today was Patrice Martin. The engineer was Vortex Zorniak. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. You can find me on Twitter at Michael_Lippin, spelled L-I-P-I-N. I hope you have a great week.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On June 8th, much of the world observes United Nations World Oceans Day. The idea is to remind people how important the world's oceans are to all life on Earth, to celebrate their beauty, and to bring attention to the impact human activity has on the oceans. This year, the theme is Healthy Oceans, Healthy Planet, with special emphasis on plastic pollution. The world's oceans cover nearly three-fourths of the Earth's surface and contain 97% of our planet's water. They produce over half of our oxygen, help regulate our climate, absorb carbon dioxide, and support the greatest abundance of life on our planet. Nearly half of all species on Earth depend on the oceans for survival, and for many of the rest, including for people, the oceans improve the quality of life. The oceans are also indispensable to the world's economy because they are key to transportation and recreation. And inasmuch as over 95% of the underwater realm remains unexplored, it is nearly a certainty that their depths may hold the cure to many a disease, the resolution to many a problem. And yet, as much as 40% of the world's oceans are heavily affected by human activities that result in pollution, overfishing, and loss of coastal habitats. Of particular concern is plastic debris. Some of it comes from ships that ply our rivers, lakes, and seas, and eventually makes its way into the ocean. But about 8 million metric tons of plastic waste washes off land into the ocean each year. Once there, it begins to break down until it turns into small fragments known as microplastics. Plastics are a serious threat because they degrade very slowly, entangle sea creatures, damage habitats like coral reefs, and are ingested by marine animals. Researchers have documented impacts of plastic on over 650 different marine species, including sea turtles, seals, whales, dolphins, porpoises, seabirds, and fish. On World Oceans Day, we must remember that the health and safety of our oceans is our collective responsibility, one that we cannot afford to neglect. Only through good stewardship can we safeguard the health of our oceans and ensure that the oceans continue to meet the needs of future generations. What will you do to protect our ocean? Tell us on social media using hashtag OurOcean2015.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.